Anybody that's brave and bold and brilliant and gives themselves goosebumps is on the road to brilliance, basically. They're going to achieve something amazing.
Well, welcome to Brave, Bold, Brilliant. I am here today with two incredible female role models. They are known as the Antarctic Fire Angels, but they do have their real names as well. So we've got George Gilbert and we've got Bex Openshaw-Rowe. So nice to see you both.
Hi.
Hello.
So I've been really excited about this all day, and you know, you two are pretty phenomenal with not only what you do in terms of your day job and the life journey you've been on, but also this incredible feat of achievement that you've just recently completed. So let me just pick out some of the highlights from that. When I was reading through, I was like, oh my gosh. So I'll do that and then we'll get to learn a little bit more around how you got into this in the first place. So you actually have completed the Antarctica to the South Pole trip, which was unsupported, carrying your own food and equipment, which is 100 kilograms each, 15 stones, 7 pounds. It's the equivalent of 29 marathons, took you 52 days, 745 miles in temperatures of minus 41 degrees. My God, what have I missed?
I think just the weight of the pulks. I think Bex's was 121 kilos and mine was 110. So well, we're just picking up on the small stuff there.
My God, that makes a huge difference. So this is really phenomenal. So I guess the first natural question is, how did you decide to do this and what was the catalyst? So maybe come to you, Bex, in terms of what the catalyst was, and then we'll come to you, George, for the how. How did you plan it?
Well, this idea is basically all George's fault, pretty much. So every terrible day in Antarctica, I blamed George because it was her fault. But the idea, we were inspired by another group of women called the Ice Maidens, which was an all-female army team that went to Antarctica in 2015 and did a similar expedition. And myself and George were at Women in the Fire Service networking weekend in 2019. We didn't actually know each other then, so we were complete strangers. But one of the women from that team was doing a talk for us. And, you know, it was massively inspiring. You know, all the imagery, everything was just wow. And basically George, we were all inspired, but George went one step further to ask Sophie, the lady, is this something that a bunch of firefighters could do? And she was absolutely amazing. She said, yep, definitely, gave George all of the contacts and help, said, you know, give me a call in a couple of weeks. We can have a chat about how to get started. And that's where the idea was born, basically.
Wow, my God. So you're getting the blame, George, for getting you two into this.
Yeah.
So what happened after that when you actually sort of, you know, had that initial conversation? How did it sort of escalate from there?
Escalate is the right word there. So it accelerated and escalated quite quickly. And basically, just reached out for other team members. And I don't know if you're aware, but we were a team of six before. And through circumstances, promotion, family commitments, and, you know, the level of training, you know, commitment to training that's required. And then at the end was financial difficulties. We ended up with just the two of us going, because we've always said that the message is the most important thing. Bex got on board straight away and was like, said yes, and then went home and said, can I? I got back in touch with Sophie then, who is the one of the Ice Maidens, and just basically said, look, can we come and meet? And she gave me all the contacts that I needed for the company that help you organize everything. And then the game plan was launched then as to how we were going to fundraise, how we were going to fit all the training in, because you have to, if you're unguided on an expedition like this, you have to qualify for it. So there's a certain amount of hours and specific training that you have to put in order to qualify for it. So we had to fit in all the training, which is a huge annual leave commitment from ourselves and our partners as well. So they have also sacrificed the last 4.5 years of their lives for us to do this expedition as well. So, and that's how it just snowballed into something quite big and brilliant then from then on.
Oh, amazing. I mean, and you know what I love about this? You kind of said yes and then figure out how to do it later. You know?
Yeah.
And that I think... So often we close opportunities down too soon, you know, and we put all the blockers in the way. And my God, there must have been a lot of blockers. But you said yes, and then just said, right, okay, what we've got our head around it. Now we need to make it happen. And Bex, what was the biggest challenge, do you think, mentally? I mean, before you left, you know, did you have wobbles? Do you have days where you're thinking, oh my God, what have we let ourselves in for? Even before you got there.
Oh gosh, yeah, 100%. I mean, I think when I agreed to doing this, I had no idea what I was letting myself in for. I think, you know, the 4 years has been like a full-time job on top of our own full-time jobs. And I think the biggest challenge, certainly towards the end, was fundraising, without a doubt. It was so tough. You know, myself and George, we're not fundraisers, you know, we're firefighters. So we had to learn so many new skills throughout those 4 years to help us with the fundraising. So like things like social media, you know, trying to self-promotion, which we were terrible at, and you know, going into meetings with companies and having to promote ourselves and try and basically get money out of companies. And yeah, it was very difficult. So we had to learn a lot of new skills over the 4 years, as well as obviously learning to ski. George and I couldn't ski at all, so we had to learn to ski. We had to learn to survive in the cold, put a tent up on the snow and ice. That's something, you know, we had never done before. Obviously learn how to use all the equipment. One of the main things was not burning the tent down, because we had our stove was inside the tent, because obviously you wouldn't cook outside, it was too cold. So just learning how, you know, how not to burn the tent down was a big thing, because that would have been embarrassing as firefighters, to cut our expedition short because we burnt the tent down. So mentally, I think in the months leading up to us actually leaving, we still weren't 100% sure we were going to go because of the fundraising. We didn't actually get all of our money until we stepped on the plane at Heathrow. Mm. So it was incredibly stressful, as you can imagine. And I definitely, in those last few months, had moments thinking that we're not going to go, we're going to let everyone down. Because, you know, at this point, it'd been 4 years in the making. We'd been around loads of schools, you know, spoken to universities, companies, all our friends and family, the fire service. Everyone was thinking, you know, because obviously we were not telling people that we hadn't got all the money yet. So everyone was thinking we were going to go. We'd made a huge deal out of it, obviously, and really built up a big following. So we couldn't let people down. So it was, yeah, incredibly stressful. And it actually did really affect my mental health towards the end, definitely. And that's before we'd even gone on the expedition.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't, when I asked the question, I wouldn't have anticipated that would have been the thing that was the most challenging. I thought it would have been about the physical training, or just the idea of being out there, you know, just the two of you in isolation for so long. You know, I wouldn't think about the finance side of it. But are you able to share how much you raised for this? Because it must be a massive amount of capital that you need in order to do it. Are you able to share that?
Well, the average cost of something like this costs around 120 to 130,000 pounds.
Wow.
Yeah. So in total, we've probably, with training and equipment as well, it's probably closer to around maybe 180. Would you say, Bex?
I'd say around a 200 grand mark, probably. Yeah. Over the 4 years as well of training.
Yeah. And it's not. And it seems a lot when you live in the UK, but when you get there and you see the logistics that's involved, the safety that's built in as well with the team around you, because you know you are on your own on the expedition itself, but the support team, should you need it, is absolutely there for you. And the structure of the company, it's called ALE. That they provide for you, it makes you feel very supported. And honestly, at Union Glacier, when they set up for 2.5 months a year, it is a village there that sets up literally for that space of time. And the staff are so dedicated to your welfare and your safety, you suddenly realise why these things cost so much. And also, it's Antarctica, and we don't want it turning into anything that's, you know, you spend £400 on a quick flight, and you can nip there, kiss the ground, and then come back again as well, you know. So you know, you want to protect it as much as you can, and I think that realization sets in when you're actually there, and you know, and you feel so small. I think so, yeah.
Yeah, you're right, actually. The whole sustainability piece, protecting the planet and doing things like this in the right way is absolutely critical. But yeah, that's a big amount of money you had to raise. And you know, when you'd actually flown out there and you're about to start, how were your feelings? How are your emotions that, oh my God, you've had the huge relief that you managed to even make it and you got the funding that you needed. You've done your training, but that's just a start, right? You haven't even even started the expedition. What's going through your mind like the night before, say?
Yeah, I mean, when we flew out to Antarctica, I felt incredibly emotional seeing, you know, as we flew over the continent and as we started to land into Antarctica, it was just, you know, amazing. So, you know, excitement, and also I think a bit of nerves were definitely starting to set in. It was very real. You know, once you see the ice in the continent and you land there, you suddenly realise, right, this is actually serious now. We are actually doing it. And I think the night before, I definitely was awake with, feeling a bit anxious and nervous. You know, I think I worried about, you know, what if George and I don't get on and we're stuck out there for, you know, 50 odd days? Am I going to have an injury? Is my body going to survive? And also, you know, is the weather going to be all right? Are we going to, you know, are we going to come across something awful? You know, it's there were so many unknowns, even though we trained as much as we could and done as much preparation as we could. We've never been to Antarctica. We've never been across that area. So there was a lot of unknowns. And yeah, I was definitely anxious and awake, I think, that night before, and excited, I think. But as we waved goodbye to the base camp, because we skied from the base camp, which we were the first people to do that on an expedition as well. Yeah, it was certainly a bit like, oh, right, we're on our own now. That's it. We're off. And yeah, it was kind of like, oh, great. And oh, God, you know, that kind of feeling. Yeah.
Fantastic. And George, you know, Bex mentioned there around, are you going to get on? You know, I mean, the two of you said you didn't know each other very well, you know, before you got into this whole idea. How did you get on?
Well, there's a reason we're called Snip and Snippy. We call each other Snip and Snippy. And I mean, we get on really, really well. And you could probably base it on a couple of sisters that bicker. But what was so important and what became really, really important to us is that it didn't matter if we would snip at each other sort of once or twice a day, maybe 10 times a day, however many times it was, that you had to put that aside because it was basically for the greater good. So, I mean, you could sit there and you could harbour all this like bad anger and temper towards this other person because they've done the most petty of things, you know, and it may not be into the evening. You're like, well, we snipped at each other now, and there's no point in bringing it up again because it was so petty, and it's just not worth bringing it up. It's a waste of words, you know, when you could be thinking and talking about the next day and being constructive. And so it's because that we were able to snip at each other and put it to one side that our relationship sort of got a lot fatter then, and we've got a lot more rich in its at its sort of base level, really. And now, in testament that we're still really good friends. And it's one of the questions that comes up in all the speaking engagements that we've had since we've been home. It's one of the main questions that comes up, as well as going to the toilet. So yeah, the two main questions.
Well, now you've brought up the toilet. I mean, you're in quite close confines, right? You know, I mean, you've got to go. But that must have been, that, I guess, all dignity goes out the window, right? You just got to do what you're going to do, presumably.
Yeah, you have to lose all your inhibitions quite quickly. And I think, I suppose, because we'd done quite a lot of training in Norway and Sweden before we'd gone out there. So we kind of had that like awkward time of, you know, having to go to the toilet in front of each other. And when we first started, when we put the camp up every night, we would dig a hole, and that would be our toilet hole outside of the tent. But as it got colder, like I said, that then became an ensuite toilet in the like vestibule area of the tent, because it was just so cold, you know. And also from a sort of safety point of view, we didn't want to get frostbite on our hands because you have to take your gloves off, or our bums. So it was just safer to go inside, which sounds awful, but it was a lot nicer than having to go outside to the toilet.
Oh,
but it's quite difficult as a woman, really, because, you know, when we're on the go during the day, because we'd ski for sort of 10 hours or more, obviously you can't, you know, you haven't got any shelter. So as a woman, it was quite difficult having to, you know, stop and take your trousers down to go to the toilet and exposing your skin. And often it was, you know, the wind was howling. So George and I became each other's wind blockers during the daytime and toilet roll holders. So yeah, all the inhibitions are gone and you just have to get on with it, literally. You know, we knew exactly everything about each other's toilet habits.
One thing that was essential to the friendship is that when you did go to the toilet, you got the wind direction correct.
I love it. But, you know, like you say, you know, this is survival stuff. You know, it's not to be messed around with. I mean, we're kind of having a bit of a laugh about it now, but I can only imagine the practicalities. And just like you say, no one wants frostbite on their bottom. I mean, that just, or anywhere else for that matter, you know. But this must have been challenging. Let's talk a little bit about the food side of it then, because, you know, what are you eating? Is it rehydrated stuff? Is it gels? Is it proper food? You know, are you hunting for stuff? Are you cooking? What was the food situation?
Well, I have to say, sometimes I did feel hunted by Bex when she was particularly hungry. Sort of, you know, eyeing up a calf in the night or something, I don't know. But by the end, we were all sort of sinewy sticks anyway, so it wouldn't have been that tasty. But food consisted of, in the morning, we would have granola and dried coconut milk. So that was 1,000 calories. So there's an awful lot of calories in those two ingredients there. So it was nice to keep that nice and simple, although halfway through you were thinking, I've really had enough of this. And then through the day, then it's just snacking. So you don't stop for lunch, although we would stop for breaks every 2 hours. It's just snacking. That would be dried meat, cheese. Great when it's frozen, not. And lots and lots and lots of chocolate, nutty chocolate, you know, high, and just thinking calories and fat. That's all you're thinking of, you know, and gum health went out the window at that point, moment in time, for 52 days. And in the evening then is freeze-dried food. So we went with Expedition Foods, and they're really tasty. They're not sort of this reputation that freeze-dried food generally has. And it's come a long way in the last sort of 10, 15 years, just freeze-dried food. And we had like a fantastic selection. It'd be spag bol or a chili, macaroni cheese. You could put your frozen cheese in too, which is nice, cheese and cheese. You can have, you know, any combination that you wanted, really. And we had a couple of puddings there as well, didn't we, for later on in the expedition. So, the food was actually okay. You just need to get your head around the fact that it's going to be different. That's all.
Yeah. And have you, excuse my ignorance, but are you taking all of the food, all of the provisions from day one to last you the entire journey?
Yeah. Yeah, so we took 55 days worth of food, and that's what we took right at the beginning from the first day, and dragged the whole lot with us. The food probably is one of the things that weighs the most, I think, in our pods. So we basically planned for 5,500 calories a day, but we would burn more than that because we still lost a lot of weight between us. And then that would weigh about 1.3 kilos daily then. So if you can think 55 times 1.3 kilos, quite a lot of weight. And that's just the food, not the fuel and our equipment and everything as well. Hence why our pulks were so heavy.
Wow, yeah, that's incredible. And obviously, I mean, you are both incredibly physically fit, given that you're both firefighters. So I guess that would have given you some advantages, I'm assuming, compared to maybe other people that wouldn't have that base level of fitness. But are there other aspects that you've sort of benefited from, do you think, with your background in the fire service that you brought to that expedition, not exhibition, that you brought to the whole experience that kind of stood you in good stead, do you think?
Yeah, resilience, I think. And, you know, just pressing through what feels like the most, you know, inhospitable environment. You know, we go into certain fires, And you know, it'll feel a really hostile environment. Even though you're trained to an extremely high level, it'll still feel very hostile. And being able to sort of push yourself through for a good outcome, I think, is so that baseline resilience is built into us. It's ingrained in us through all our training that we've done over our careers. Definitely for me.
I think as well, being able to change the plan quickly. You know, in our jobs, we turn up to work and we don't know what the day will bring. And I think even though it was like Groundhog Day every day when we were in Antarctica, what we did change our plan that we'd set out. So, you know, like the amount of the distance that we were doing every day, we weren't hitting that. So we had to get our heads around that. But also the structure of the day, we had planned to ski for, I think, 75 minutes and have a 15 minute break. But after a few days, we'd realised it was a bit cold. It was annoying to stop all the time. And we changed our plan around that, and then did 2 hours of 2 hours, and then would stop. So just a change in things, and I think being able to deal with something if the situation changes quickly, being able to deal with that. And I think because of our roles, we were able to cope with that, like weather coming in really quickly, dealing with a situation that's gone a bit awry, that type of thing, we were able to deal with. So I think that definitely set us up for that.
Yeah, no, I can imagine that flexibility and resilience. And, you know, obviously to do something like this, it kind of breaks all perceptions or misconceptions, boundaries about what's possible, what's not possible, whether, you know, for anyone, regardless of gender, but probably in particular for women that are maybe pushing out of their comfort zone into different career paths, different business opportunities, different physical, you know, challenges, etc. But was that your main purpose to kind of challenge the norms and show that, you know, anyone, in particular women, can do anything if they put their mind to it? Was that the main driver for doing this, do you think?
Yeah, definitely. We always said from the start that Antarctica was the attention grabber. I know it's phenomenal. You think you need something as big as that. We basically risked our lives to prove our point. And to inspire future generations, women of our age as well. I've got friends who are, you know, approaching 50, and they've said, you know, thank you for doing that, because I thought, you know, my children are about to leave, that they're going to start driving soon, and I felt like my career is over as mother, and I didn't feel like I could, you know, sort of push anymore or do anymore or anything like that. And, you know, we're not expecting anybody to go to Antarctica or anything like that, but it's just inspiring somebody to go out and do something amazing, and then in turn inspire somebody else. So it doesn't matter what you do, how you do it, you are inspiring somebody somewhere in the globe, across the globe. You may not ever meet them. They may be your neighbor or your best friend. So it was literally about that. And that was always the absolute key message, the core message for us.
And I guess when the times are tough, you know, you come back to that core kind of reason why and that core purpose to keep you going, I guess, when it is difficult.
Oh gosh, yeah. I mean, you know, we had a lot of difficult times out there, and you know, at some points I thought we were never going to make it to the South Pole. And I think the main thing that kept us going was not letting people down, and that message that we wanted. And that literally was it. You know, we had two options out there. It was either we keep going to the South Pole or we get evacuated. There was no other option in between. And we never felt like we wanted to quit, I don't think, ever through the whole journey, even when times were tough. But yeah, the main thing that kept us going was not letting people down.
Yeah, so you said you never felt like you would quit, which is great to hear. How much was the relationship that you've got kind of testament to that? Did you find that, you know, Bex, maybe one day you might be having a wobble and George would be there to kind of pick you up and say, no, come on, we can do this, and vice versa? Did you find that you would sometimes, you know, have different moments where you weren't feeling amazingly great and the other one was there to support? How important was that teamwork, I guess, really?
And 100%. And being a pair as well, that it couldn't be more important. Because as a three or a four, you can spread that weight or that responsibility amongst you. But in a pairing, if one person isn't having a great day, it is very, very reliant on the other person. So absolutely 100%, you hit the nail on the head there, definitely. So, but then there'll be times where, because you're skiing for 10 hours a day, and we probably won't be speaking to each other that much, especially if the weather's bad. So if you start having a bad moment during that 10-hour rotation, you're very much stuck on your own. And in order to pick yourself up out of it and not rely on other people. So there was a combination of it, of both of them going on. But then when you came back in the tent and you were safe and you could have these conversations, it was important to share that and what was going on for you that day, you know, and so you can, you know, the other person and the team build a picture for the next day. And not that the next day ever changed. It was always going to be 10 hours of pulling or 25 kilometers, 28 kilometers, whatever we decided to do. It would always be the same. But then you would have, you're just basically sharing that knowledge of what you've been through for that day, at that moment in time.
Amazing. It's incredibly inspiring. And, you know, your backgrounds have got similarities, obviously, because you're both in the fire service. And George, I think you've been, what, 26 years, is it? I think I read in the service. So you started pretty young when you got into kind of being a firewoman. And back then, it probably would have been, what, a very unusual profession to have chosen 26 years ago, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, there were women across the UK that have joined, you know, a long time before, especially London Fire Brigade. I think the first woman joined in 1986 in LFB. But I mean, I joined Retained, which is now called On Call, in 98. And then I joined whole time in 2000, which bumps me up to the 26 years of service. But yeah, I mean, back then, we were four women on the training course. And then there was one woman already in the service. So out of that training course, we made the entire brigade up to five women. So that's whole time. I couldn't give the stats for what was then retained, but yeah, for whole time. But my word, how things have changed now, you know, it's coming on leaps and bounds. And the best thing is it's happening organically, you know. So I came in under the sort of banner, although I passed the same fitness tests as everybody else, I came in under the banner of you only got this job because you're a woman, you know, and colleagues way past gone now. They've retired, been retired a very long time now. And that's what the language was, you know, around you. You only got this job because ... And yeah, it felt like such a shame. And it always felt like a fight for me right in the beginning. And then, you know, things changed very, very quickly. You know, you sort of put your big girl pants on, and you go, do you know what? I'm not competing with anybody. I believe in myself, and I don't have to prove myself anymore to anybody, because I did that in order to get into the fire service and just basically stop. And I had to stop myself from doing that as well, you know. So I had to stop myself from actually agreeing with them, going, well, I probably did, you know. I so did not. And when I realized that for myself, then that obviously that came across with the old guys that I was working with. And thankfully, things have moved on very, very, very well and very quickly, you know, and we're still heading in that amazing direction, which is brilliant.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and we'll come to Bex, your kind of background in terms of sport and how you got into the service. But, you know, I had similar experiences, you know, from a business point of view. I was always the only woman in the boardroom with a P&L, you know, and very much sort of a bit of a lone voice at certain times. But I was a bit like you, George. I used to think, well, I'm here for a reason. I'll do the best job I can and try not to walk into a situation thinking there's going to be a problem, because there probably will be if I do. And just kind of try and be yourself, really. But thankfully, the world is moving forward. We've still got more to do, though. Like you say, you've had to go to extremes to kind of get that really strong message across. And it is getting better. But, you know, whole diversity, equity, inclusion of all shapes and sizes and cultures and sexual orientation, whatever, you know, gender, disability, you know, there's a lot more to be done in all of these areas. And I think, to like you say, the shift from when you started to where you are now, it's refreshing to see, but we still got to keep going, haven't we, with proving that actually gender should be irrelevant. Unfortunately, yeah. we're still talking about it. But Bex, for you, you actually started really your background in sport, didn't you? And then came into the sort of the fire service later. I think were you 37 when you joined the service?
Yeah, I'm a late bloomer in the fire service. So yeah, I spent the majority of my life doing international sport. I did have jobs, part-time jobs, to fund my sport when I wasn't quite at the top end throughout my life. And I was actually a teacher before I got into the fire service. So I was a P and geography teacher. And I thought that was the career for me. But after over a few years and then sort of the realisation that I was retiring from sport, I think I looked at kind of my life, how my life would be in years to come. And I kind of realised that teaching wasn't enough for me, I think. And I didn't really want to, I had no ambitions to progress in teaching. So I had a lot of friends in the fire service at the time. And I was living in London then. And they'd said to me, why don't you just apply for the fire service? You know, we think you'd be brilliant at it. It's a great job. Just give it a go. So I kind of applied on a whim, really, because I was still in teaching then. And thought, I'll just go through the process. And, you know, if I get through, I'll just keep going until I need to actually think about it seriously. And then I got through all the way to the interview stage, because it's quite a long process to get into the fire service. And so then I thought, right, this is serious now. I need to actually tell people and speak to work and things. And then obviously I eventually got in. And I've got to say, it's the best thing I ever did. I have no regrets about changing careers. And it was a big gamble at the time, because I had a perfectly great career as a teacher. You know, I worked in some brilliant schools in London, and I loved teaching the kids. It was just the other stuff around it that I wasn't sure about. And but yeah, once I joined the service and I started doing my training and then getting on station, I just absolutely loved it, and still do, obviously still love it, you know, almost 6 years in now. And yeah, it's just the best job ever. And I wish I had done it earlier in my life. But obviously I was having a great time playing sport. So, but yeah, it's a brilliant job. But like you said, there still needs to be lots more women applying. I think the latest figures is 8.7% of the fire service are women, operational women. So that's still pretty low, isn't it? But I mean, I see quite a lot of women in my service. I think there's about 5 women on my station, which is so there's a woman on every single watch, I think, which is great. And I do feel like I see a lot of women out and about when we go on incidents and stuff. But we are still very much in the minority. And, you know, obviously we'd love that to change. So.
Yeah, what do you think needs to happen? I mean, some of it, I think, is around education, isn't it? And like, you know, speaking to young girls when they're in school and saying, you know, this is a profession that you could do. I mean, I see a lot of this in aviation, my background being in the travel industry. So, you know, an organisation like EasyJet as an airline, you know, to have female pilots years ago was unheard of. Whereas, you know, Johan Lundgren, who's the group CEO, strategically said, no, I really want a diverse workforce at every single level. I want female pilots. And, you know, they set a target. I think it was, not that I necessarily agree with targets, but sometimes you have to have a goal, right, in order to aim. And I think now EasyJet have gone from pretty much zero to nearly 30% female pilots, which is phenomenal over the last sort of 6-7 years. And, you know, so I think every organisation has to have a look at where they're starting from and then where do they want to get to and what are the initiatives that need to happen. But I think some of it is around making young girls aware of the different career choices. And actually for young boys as well, that might want to get into more female, you know, centric historic professions. I'd like to see more human resources, male, you know, males in that space tends to be very female dominated, doesn't it? So I think it goes both ways. But what would you like to see happen? What do you think needs to happen in terms of making a big shift?
Early engagement with kids, you know, going into schools, youth groups, community groups. And, you know, we go into some schools and the teachers still call us firemen. You know, and, you know, we're firefighters. Everybody's a firefighter, no matter what gender. We all do the same job as well. And which is disappointing as far as I'm concerned, you know. So it's just early engagement with the kids. So they get the terminology early on, and that any role is open to absolutely anybody. You know, it's not just firefighting, policing, Nursing, you know, nursing is very female dominated, and it's the presumption that you're going to be a woman. Midwifery as well, you know, but the language that the name needs to change as well, you know, so it's up to them what they want to change it to. But, you know, being a midwife has to change. And, you know, I always think it's really funny that you find lots of male gynecologists, not many female gynecologists, and yet most women who work with women are midwives. So I find that a really bizarre statistic to try and get my head around, to be fair. So I don't know what's happening at early level in that particular sphere, you know?
Yeah. I think it's about probably historic stereotypes, isn't it? And maybe a lack of role models, but it's momentum, isn't it? You know, you don't want tokenism, but I think as soon as people can see someone that looks like them, speaks like them, maybe comes from their social background or whatever, they go, oh, it's possible for that person. I can see a path for this as well. And I think those role models are so important, aren't they? And how important have role models been in both of your kind of lives and career, would you say?
Yeah, I think I've had quite a few role models over the years, you know, through the different sports I've done, teachers that I've had growing up. And I think they're incredibly, you look up to these people, not for necessary direction, but they inspire you to maybe do, you know, I don't know, a certain sport or something, or go for something. They're almost like the role models are, they almost champion you to move forward, to go and try and achieve something that you weren't sure you wanted to do. And I think visibility is massive. That's the biggest thing. And especially in our roles, I think as female firefighters, being visible and out in the public eye and around the fire service as well is a big thing. And when I was in the recruitment process, I tried to look for more female firefighters. I wanted to know who they were, what they did, are they normal people, you know? And I couldn't find any at the time, and we're only talking 6 years ago, so it's not that long ago. You know, we had social media and everything then, so it's visibility is a massive, massive key, I think, to, and like George said, going into schools, speaking to young people, that, and them realizing that it is a job that they can do. And I hope that we're being great role models as well for younger people and women really as well around the, you know, across the country really, that showing, you know, what women can do, what we can achieve, and just, yeah, having the confidence to go and do something.
Yeah, 100%. And that's why it's great to be able to, you know, have these kind of conversations, put out all of the inspiring things that you've achieved, because it helps others. And that's really the reason for me having the podcast in the first place. Well, it is the reason. And George, for you, have you had role models through your kind of career as well? I mean, obviously you've been in the fire service a long time, but, you know, before that, during that, any particular standout individuals that have really helped you?
Well, I've got to say, Bex is my current role model. I have to say that.
I lined you up nicely there.
Yeah, you did.
No, I'm teasing. We don't want to make that ego any bigger than it is. No, that's a tease as well. No, it's fine. She's a very, very humble person. No, I mean, I didn't have that many. There's a big difference between the 70s and 80s, and then 80s and 90s role models that were coming through. And, you know, I wasn't really into sort of music and pop stars and stuff like that, especially of the 70s and early 80s. So I didn't really have that many role models growing up, you know. It was only things that was literally seeing in newspapers back then, you know. It's just, and believe it or not, and on TV, on the two or three channels that we had on TV back then. So, I mean, two of my sort of role models, if you can call them role models, is one of them was Wonder Woman from back in the 70s and 80s. And when you look back now, it's just like, wow, you know. But she was, all I saw as a young kid was a woman kicking ass, you know, and bringing in the baddies and being like super cool. It didn't occur to me what she was wearing or anything of the objectification of women and stuff. And the other one, you know, I had no idea what her politics was. I didn't know anything about parties and stuff. And that was Margaret Thatcher, for the exact same reasons, is that she was a woman kicking ass in a male-dominated arena, you know. And, you know, I watched something a program on her. It was a dramatized series on her, you know, a few years ago. And what I didn't realize is that she was so supportive of other women that were coming into politics. And, you know, she would invite them in and have a coffee with them and invite them to sit down and things like that. And one of the statements she came out with was we have to support each other because no one else is going to do it. Yeah. And you know, and that's just a really amazing statement. So it doesn't matter what you thought about her politics, what she did to the UK or anything like that. You remove all of that and just get down to the basics of what she who she was as a human being and as a woman in a very influential place to make change and in a very male dominated era.
Yeah, yeah, you're right, absolutely. And the other thing about Maggie Thatcher as a character was she had Dennis, right? She had Dennis there as her kind of wingman, her champion, quietly, you know, probably partly saying, get off your high horse, you're just Maggie at home, you know, you're not... but also encouraging her to push and to really move forward. So, you know, I think our partners are, you know, partners in life, partners in business, our families, our friends around us, but in particular partners, whether that's a love partner, business partner, whatever, often are the unsung heroes when we're pushing out of our comfort zone and we're trying to do amazing things. And, you know, for both of you in your day-to-day roles as firefighters, you know, you're going into you can go into a potentially life and death situation every single day. And then, of course, you go and do this phenomenal, you know, achievement in the Antarctica for 52 days away, plus all the 4-year preparation. So your partners must be incredibly supportive of you. I mean, how important has that been on the journey?
Oh, I mean, I don't think we could have done it without our other halves. I'm quite fortunate that my other half is a firefighter as well.
Okay.
So it's quite nice, you know, when I, although sometimes talking shop in at home is a bit boring, but It's good to come home and be able to speak to my other half and for them to sort of understand maybe what I've been going through at work and things like that. But yeah, the last 4 years has been a big sacrifice for them as well, massively. You know, we've been having to go away for training, use our annual leave up for training. We've had to be quite selfish, really. And I think our partners have had to be incredibly understanding of that and supportive of it. You know, and that was another reason we don't want to let our partners down either when we're out in Antarctica, you know, after everything they've had to sacrifice and put up with over those 4 years. And then obviously us leaving them for 3 months pretty much to hold the fort while we're away and deal with all the life stresses and look after the dogs on their own. we couldn't have done it without them, really, not at all. And also, I think the biggest thing as well is the support when things aren't going right or they're not going our way. You know, they're there to pick us up and keep positive, keep pushing us forward, saying you can do it, you're going to get the money, you know, you'll be fine, or that kind of stuff. It's they've always been that positive person in our ear when we've been struggling or finding times tough.
Yeah, fantastic. And George, presumably the same for you. People, you know, people in your life must have been a huge support for you.
Oh yeah, totally second everything that Bex has said there. It's they're pivotal in everything, really, and we wouldn't have been able to do it unless we had their support, you know. And you know, the first 12 months was very much like, you know, will they do it? Will they won't do it? You know, it's probably not going to happen. And then sort of 12 to 18 months in, it's like, oh, yes, they are going to do it. And it's the same for us as well. It was all of a sudden, oh, right, we really are committed to this now. Let's keep going. And yeah, and then especially when we were out there, because obviously we were able to ring home when we needed to. We had a satellite phone and stuff, although we needed to be careful with the minutes. It's very expensive to use a satellite phone. Yeah, so we knew that they were there at the drop of a hat, you know, and there's a time difference as well. So when we were in the tent and just settling down for the evening, sort of like around 9 o'clock, it's like it's 1 o'clock in the morning in the UK, you know, so we're sending a message, you know, oh, everything's gone really well today, don't worry, you know. And so we forget that back here is that they're waiting up for a message from us to say that everything's okay, you know. So, I mean, and that, for 3 months of waiting up till 1 a.m. or 2.5 months, you know, to 1 a.m. for a message is draining in itself, because they've got full-time jobs as well.
Yeah. Absolutely. And Bex, you were saying earlier on when I was asking about what was the most kind of stressful or concerning part of the whole thing, and you said that with raising the finance and that kind of really affected your mental health at the time as well. How did you get through that part? And because I think with mental health, thankfully, again, we talk about stuff, don't we, more openly now. But that's not easy, is it, always to kind of bounce back when you're having some of those kind of moments?
I mean, talking was the biggest thing to my wife Kirsty, but also I think I had to have a conversation with George to say, look, I'm really overwhelmed, I'm really struggling, I don't feel myself, and I'm pretty tough mentally, but it really got to me. And George was like, right, I'll take some work off you, give you a bit of space, head space really is what I needed, and just time to kind of just chill a little bit, I think. And my head was so busy and stressed, I think I just needed to have something, things taken off me for a bit. And that's what George did. And that was a huge help. And just, I think just to hear someone say, look, it's fine, let me take some stuff off you. Just deal with yourself at the moment. And just to give you that headspace was enough for me to kind of then, after chatting to Kirst as well and telling her how I was feeling, enough for me to kind of deal with it then, I think, and kind of feel better after, after a few days or a week or whatever. And then obviously then, then when we have better news and stuff like that obviously helps then, doesn't it, when you start getting more positive news. I think the constant knockbacks and the stress of still having money to find was just, was just really building up. And it just, the old thing of your cup had spilled over basically, and that's what was happening to me at the time.
Yeah, no, and it's a good watch out for anyone listening to this. If you're in a stressful situation, and it might be a totally different scenario, but if you feel that you're feeling like you're drowning from from the pressure, I think you're right. Talk to someone, recognize what's going on. There's no one solution necessarily, but we've got to put our own oxygen mask on first, haven't we? Because otherwise we can't be helpful for those around us and do what we want to do in terms of putting good out in the world. So I think it takes a strong person actually to say, hey, I need a bit of help here. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And when you came back, what was the reaction? What was the feeling? Because you came back in on the well, you finished on the 11th of January. Presumably you didn't get back into the UK until what, a few days later, a week later. But when you came home, what was that like?
So we had 1 night at the pole, and then we flew back to Union Glacier, and then we had to wait, I think, 5 days for that flight from Union Glacier back to Punta Arenas. And then it was another day or so then from then. It's another like 24 hours traveling back again to the UK then. So but arriving back, back in the UK was it was relief. And comfort and familiarity, and we've moaned about the rain and everything, but I mean honestly, I missed the smell of rain. I missed the trees and the birds and all the different sensory things, that input that we have in the UK, and Antarctica, there's no smell unless you make it, so in the cooking and stuff like that. So you go outside and there's absolutely no smell, there's no trees, there's nothing. So having that sensory stimulation, what felt amazing to me, and I always thought I'd feel a bit overwhelmed by it, but honestly, I wasn't. I missed it so much. I was really pleased. I was really pleased to go out in the rain. It's a very weird feeling, and I'm still quite happy now, to be fair. I don't think I'll ever moan about the rain again.
About for you, Bex? What was it like coming home?
Oh yeah, it's similar to George really. I was really excited to see the other half, and just to get home to those home comforts, I think. And I'd been absolutely craving bacon sandwiches throughout the whole expedition. So food's a big thing for me, and I was really excited to get home and obviously have my bacon sandwich, but also see the dogs. So I've got two little mini dash hounds, and 3 months away from them as well as the other half is a long old time, isn't it? So I was excited to get back home and see them, and probably have a bit of normality, because what we've done is so far from our kind of normal life. To get back to normality after that amount of time was just, it was really nice, and I was excited for that as well. And like George is saying, like the environment obviously is completely different. So it was nice to be back to seeing landmarks and trees and things, but also because in Antarctica it's 24 hours daylight. So when I came back and you know, saw like the dark sky and stars, I was kind of like a bit transfixed at staring at the sky for a while, just looking at the stars, thinking, wow, look at those stars. But yeah, so I think you just really appreciate these small little simple things in life that we always take for granted because we see them all the time, and suddenly, you know, we didn't have them for a good couple of months, 3 months. So yeah, it was good to be home. We've been away for a long time as well, so it was good to be back.
And what's the response been? Because obviously, you know, you did this to raise awareness, to really send a strong message out that anything is possible for anyone, but in particular as a woman, you know, that there aren't any limits. You can do whatever you want. Just you've just got to believe it, I suppose, first and foremost. But how's the response been from the sort of the wider community, the press, etc., since you've been back?
Amazing. Like there's so much positivity around it as well. You know, you expect a little bit of trolling and things like that, but honestly, there's barely been anything at all. And there's articles in online and in newspapers coming out that we didn't even know that that were going to come out. You know, once one newspaper sort of prints it, and then the next one, it's a bit of a snowball effect. Then I've got friends messaging us going, "Oh, you're in this paper now," or "You're in that paper now." So friends have been like keeping these snapshots of newspapers and things like that to keep for themselves. And so the response has been amazing, and the response from other fire services as well. So they're asking us to go and speak to their fire cadets and to their workforce as well and stuff. So to be able to get that message out much, much further is wonderful, you know, and it's worked. Basically, risking our lives worked.
Well, thank God. That's a relief. But no, I mean, it is, and I just think this is the start. Do you know what I mean? I just think, obviously, you know, when you're going through something as huge as that, and it's very hard to comprehend it, and you've articulated it beautifully. But I think once you've done something like this, your lives are never going to be the same. And the legacy that you leave, the mark you leave in this world, you know, is going to be up there, right? And I just feel that, you know, this is just going to go from strength to strength in terms of the opportunity to share the message, and who knows what the next adventure might be. Do you think there's another one? Have you got something else in mind, or is it too early to say?
Well, we do have something in mind, maybe for towards the end of next year. Yeah. So, but you're right with the message. You know, we want to keep that rolling and rolling for as long as we can. And I think probably by doing something else a little bit crazy, that will help to continue the message and keep us kind of not in the spotlight, but keep us out there really. And it's looking likely that we're going to try and do 7 marathons in 7 days on 7 continents. So yeah, it's a bit silly because I'm not a runner.
But you weren't a skier either, were you, Ben?
True, so, that is, you know, true. That's true.
That'd be amazing. Well, I can't wait to see that. We'll have to have you back on after you've done that, and then you know, I'll talk about that experience. But I've got a couple of last questions for you, if I may. So, George, what did you learn about yourself during that trip? During either the build up, the whole thing. What did you learn about yourself?
Patience and tolerance, two things. Definitely. And that everybody else's stuff is just as important as your stuff. That's probably the three main things I learned about myself, which as a 50-year-old woman, you'd think I probably should have learned that a lot earlier.
I love it. Yeah, brilliant. And what about you, Bex?
I think I just learned that I can really push my body or my mind really far beyond what I thought my limits were. You know, I've pushed my body pretty far in, you know, over the years with sport, but this was something else, I think. And during the last few weeks, we really didn't know how or what was fueling us to get up every morning and ski for 10 to 12 hours. And so, yeah, it's really quite impressive how much, you know, when you've got this goal and you don't want to let people down, how far you can really push your body and your mind to get there.
Yeah, fantastic. And actually, you know, George, you've mentioned age a little bit around, you know, the 50s. I'm 52 this year. So, yeah, it is a thing. You're never too young or never too old. I think that's the point. And, you know, I just think we constantly reinventing ourselves. And isn't that where the joy comes? Because we just become better versions of ourselves, and we might mess up along the way, but that's okay because we learn from it. And I think there is a, it's a really inspirational around age as well. And that, you know, sometimes social media isn't kind, in particular to women as we age. Men seem to become silver foxes and quite glam, you know, kind of accepted. And us women, you know, sometimes things start sagging a little bit, and it can all be a bit cruel, can't it, how it plays out, which is total nonsense, of course. But I do think that that whole age thing, and you can achieve anything at any age. You just got to kind of believe it yourself, really, first of all, haven't you?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, there's a certain stigma around age as well. It comes with, you know, health issues as well, you know, perimenopause, menopause. Not that that's an issue, but it is a health concern, you know, that we take forward into our 50s, you know, and that comes with its own sort of barriers, personal barriers, as well as social barriers as well, you know, and overcoming that and just saying, do you know what? It's part of women. It's part of being a woman. You know, it's going to happen to everybody. And most men every man in the universe has a mother. Their mother went through it, and they quite possibly may have daughters and wives. But there are women in every man's family somewhere. And, you know, and it's it works both ways. You know, you have to be able to support yourself as a woman going through it. Then the men in your life need to know how to support you too. So, you know, not just go, oh, that's you're the expert on that. I'm not the expert. I'm going to leave you to it, you know. So it's important, because, you know, by saying that, you feel very quite alone, like, oh, well, I came to you to share something, and now it feels like you don't want to know. So it's just perfectly natural. That's all I can say about it. Same as going to the toilet.
Yeah. I'm very open about that, aren't you two now? So, I mean, this is all about sharing, warts and all. Honestly, it's great. I think there's something like 32 signs of the menopause or symptoms of the menopause. And some days I think I've got them all. And other days I think, oh no, I haven't got any today, you know, and just never quite know what version you're going to get. But no, it's great. We've got to have an open dialogue. And I think what you two have done is absolutely phenomenal. So yeah, huge, huge congratulations. Well done. And so Bex, think about all your great experience in sport and in the fire service and everything that you've done now in your life and this great experience. Can you think of the best piece of advice that you've been given over the years?
Oh, I think for me, and Natalie, just celebrate the small things and the little wins, because it's certainly throughout my life, I think I was always looking for the next thing. You know, I'd achieve something that day or wherever it was. But then I was suddenly like straight onto the next thing. And then suddenly, you know, at some point in your life, whatever you were doing ends, and then you really regret that you didn't, you know, not dwell, but just enjoy the moments a little bit more. And I think that's the biggest thing for me, is being told just enjoy the moment and live in it for a little bit, because, you know, that'll be gone then, that moment's gone, and you'll lose that, I think.
Yeah, brilliant advice. I love that. What about you, George?
I think it would be the person that you needed when you were growing up. And I think that's just stems all the way back to when I didn't have that many female role models. And at the same time, believe in yourself. If you want to prove yourself later, then that's absolutely fine too. But just start by believing in yourself and challenging yourself as well.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's always an inside job, isn't it? We've got to start there. 100%. So no, I love that. So you've had quite an exciting, shall we say, last year. Well, 4 years build up, but last year. But if you could describe the last 12 months in one word, what would it be and why? And I'll start with you, George.
Oh, I thought you were going to start with sex, because I spoke last. No! Oh, okay, go. Unpredictable.
Unpredictable.
Yeah.
There we are. Brilliant. What about you, Bex?
Oh, roller coaster.
I can imagine. Yeah, two brilliant words there. Hey, but you survived and you came through stronger, right? All of that. Amazing.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Unpredictable and roller coaster, and probably in the most positive sense that you could possibly think of as well. So we would associate those two words with some sort of negativity, wouldn't we? But no, it's in a very, very positive way.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, context is everything, isn't it? So, yeah, very important. And George, maybe I'll go to Bex first, just to give you thinking time. Don't be mean to you. Bex, brave, bold, brilliant. When you hear that, what does it mean to you?
Oh, I think brave as in, have the confidence to challenge yourself, get out there and be brave, because we have to be brave to, if you want to achieve something, you've got to be brave and step out of your comfort zone. I think being bold, just be you and celebrate you and get out there and what was it, brilliant.
Yep.
It's the same thing really. Whatever you're achieving is brilliant. If it's making you feel good, then it's brilliant. So
Yeah.
that's fine.
Brilliant. Fantastic. What about you, George?
Well, I'm going to second that, but add goosebumps. Anybody that's brave and bold and brilliant and gives themselves goosebumps is on the road to brilliance, basically. They're going to achieve something amazing.
Yeah, fantastic. I love that. Well, honestly, you two are very unique. You're special, and what you've done is just phenomenal. I can't wait to see what's next. I think the best is yet to come, actually.
We'll see.
But thank you both. It's been an absolute joy having you on.
Thank you so
Oh,
much.
thank you.
I really hope you've enjoyed Brave, Bold, Brilliant. Don't forget to subscribe and share with all your friends. And if you've enjoyed listening, I'd love it if you'd leave me a 5-star review.